So, as they said, I work over yonder in the School of Education. My job in the School of Ed is to talk about teaching. That's something that we all do a whole lot over in the School of Education. Probably not surprising when we talk about teaching. I have the enviable position of being able to step back a little bit and talk about teaching less as an action and as a verb and think more about teaching as a noun. And to say, to bring our students the opportunity to step back and look at the school system as a social institution, to think about how it works from an organizational standpoint, how all of these different values and norms and politics interact with the work that they are going to do as professionals out in the world. And so that's the context that I'm coming to you with tonight. We're going to hopefully spend a little time tonight thinking about teaching as a profession and the organizational, institutional, and political context that surrounds it. Two caveats before we begin. First, because everybody's been talking about how excited they are about the presentation. So one note about quality. So 6 weeks ago, we had a kid. That's Evelyn. That's Evelyn and I, she should get co-author billing on the presentation. That's Evelyn and I working on the presentation last weekend. So I say this to say, it's been 6 weeks since I slept. So if I nod off or just stare into the middle distance tonight, just clap, snap your fingers, I'll come back. And to set expectations appropriately about the quality of the presentation tonight. Two, I say this because my students always kind of give me a hard time saying, Dr. Harrison, what is it that you're trying to do? Are you trying to chase us out of this business? And I say, no. It's not my job to chase you out of this, but I would never chase you out of this. I've been a part of this profession for a third of my life, working in schools, being a student first, of course. We all come to the profession of teaching from that vantage point, from being on one side of the desk, looking at the teacher, holding forth and doing their thing, to being on the other side of the desk in Leon County, Florida, Leon High School, teaching world history, AP, and honors, to working with districts and administrations, helping them to improve their practices, policies, scale them up across districts, building better effective connections between teachers and students, helping kids to see themselves in the schools in which they inhabit. So I come to the teaching profession from a place of deep love of what it is that we do. But at the same time, we're at a moment, and we're gonna talk about this a lot tonight, where I think it behooves us to approach this conversation with clear eyes about where the profession is at and potentially where it needs to go. We're gonna spend more time talking about the former and a little time talking about the latter. But that's kind of where this is coming from. And we're doing that because we're at something of an inflection point in the history of the teaching profession. I'm gonna walk that back a little bit in a few minutes, but I like to start off strong by saying, hey, we're in an inflection point in the history of the teaching profession. But it'd be pretty hard not to get the sense, just by watching the news, popular media about education over the last 2 years, that something is definitely going on. We've had teachers out walking the line, demonstrating in state capitals, withholding their labor, going on strike, forcing students out of the classroom to say, hey, something's going on. We need the public to pay attention. We need policymakers to listen to what we have to say, and we need to change how we're doing things. I talk about this in terms of labor power, and I do that for a particular reason. We'll talk about kind of the history of the profession over time, but labor has historically been the power that teachers have, particularly with regard, given the context of the gender and politics that surround the profession, to force us to pay attention to what's going on with teaching and in schools, and to exert their voice when otherwise we might be ignoring it. And so here's what that's looked like in practice. Since February of 2018, we've seen teachers engage in their exerting their labor power almost 12 times. It was, and this was pretty well popularized in the media, in West Virginia. That's a photo of the West Virginia State House, as teachers took to the line and said, enough is enough. We'll talk about what they were arguing about in just a few minutes. This is notable because in West Virginia, teachers are not part of a very strong union. Public sector employee strikes are in fact illegal, so these teachers took a substantial risk in walking out and striking that they could lose their jobs. And it just kept going from there. Oklahoma was next in April of 2018. This also found significant purchase in the media for a slightly different reason. I don't know if anybody followed this story. I like to throw a little human interest in here. This is Marley. She was excited to discover that the Reader that she inherited in her Oklahoma classroom was owned at one time by Blake Shelton, for country music fans in the audience. You can see Blake's name right there. 1982, Blake Shelton received the Look Away Reader, and Marley inherited it from him couple of decades later. Now, Marley was excited. Her mother was less excited by the prospect that her child was using the same materials to build her skills in literacy and reading that Blake did. Not any kind of commentary on Blake. I'm sure he's very literate. But we like to think that we've made some advances since then. So, teachers in Oklahoma saying our system is critically underfunded went on strike. Kentucky, Colorado, Arizona, North Carolina. That's a one-day walkout where teachers across the state bust themselves down to the Capitol and marched on the state legislature. Washington, Los Angeles Unified School District, that was pretty prevalent in the media as teachers took to the line and forced the district to listen to their arguments regarding funding of charter schools and how that was impacting public schools in the district. Also around a very contested superintendent's race, so that was a particularly opportune moment for them. Denver went on strike. West Virginia again went on strike just a couple of months ago. That's an interesting story. So in West Virginia, they went on strike, extracted significant concessions from the state legislature, including a 5% pay raise. So the legislator said, well, that's all well and good, but maybe just, you know, to pay you back, we'll try to pass some legislation. We'll put some extra accountability requirements on teachers. We'll do a little union busting while we're at it. And teachers said, well, not so fast, and went on strike again, killing the bill, by the way, which is not advanced in the West Virginia legislature. Oakland most recently went on strike. So, significant action surrounding teacher politics and the use of labor power. So what's their argument? Oh, there we go. Well, first, probably not surprising anybody, is that the first argument that teachers are making is, well, first of all, we're working for starvation wages right now. Teachers are chronically underpaid. We are forced to take multiple jobs just to support our families. I have to buy supplies for my classroom. It's eating into my disposable income. And so my choices are either to sacrifice myself again by holding multiple jobs or to exit the profession entirely just to live. Two, kind of linked to that, teachers are protesting catastrophically low funding across states, saying that states are systematically underfunding schools. They are not supporting teachers, they are not supporting students, school buildings are falling down, and enough is enough. If legislatures won't do anything about it, we will force them to in order to keep the system open. And finally, linked to these other things has been a sustained narrative that teachers have brought forward of a profession under attack, a sustained assault on teachers' professional identity, their understanding of their social worth and value, and their feeling that they are, in fact, part of a noble profession that is upheld by society, under attack, under assault. These are the claims that teachers have consistently made in these walkouts and these strikes and this labor action that they have undertaken. So, tonight, I want to talk a little bit about whether or not they have a point. Are they making arguments that are based in fact, that are reasonable? Should we listen to them? Let's take a look. My friends over in the history department would say that if we're going to understand any complex social action or social phenomenon, and this certainly is complex and social, that we probably need to have an understanding of where we've been before we look at where we are. So I want to spend a little time thinking about how teaching has evolved as an occupation or profession over the years. And that starts all the way back before America was even in America. We can go back to the colonial period in the Massachusetts Bay colonies, as well as the mid-Atlantic and the southern colonies. We've been doing this business of teaching and learning for quite a while, since we could gather kids around a tree. Most often it actually looked like like somebody's living room, where a little old lady who was literate, known as a dame, would hold classes, particularly in Massachusetts Bay, where we had our first education laws passed, saying, hey, we need to teach these kids how to read the gospel so they're not taken by Satan in the woods. But the dames would gather the children around, be paid in kind, and teach kids how to read. And that system of ad hoc education persists for a fairly long time in American history. All the way up until about 1830 or so. And in the 1830s, a lot of folks in urban areas were looking at the education system and saying, hey, this is not keeping pace with the nature of our economy, the complex nature of our society. We have immigrants coming from Western and Northern Europe who are flooding our shores and do not understand what it means to be American. And our chief vehicle for bringing them into our culture, for assimilating them, for preparing laborers to work in this new industrialized economy needs to be a new kind of school. The dames are not enough. And so we see the birth of the common schooling movement, the birth of public education in America, in which local taxes are used to provide for common schooling for children, rich, poor alike. Now, of course, some students are going to be systematically excluded for quite a while, students of color, students with exceptionalities, etc. We're largely talking about white children from certain economic strata. But still, a widening expansion of access to the system and some provision for the common good. But even then, teaching still remains in this kind of ad hoc space. We start to see the development of things like normal school, the notion that teachers need to have some kind of training to operate in the common schooling environment. It's not until we hit the early 1900s that we begin to see some real development of the profession around the turn of the century. This is when the NEA is pushing for 12 years of publicly provided schooling. We start getting secretary specialists saying we need to teach these kids a lot more about history, science, etc. Just basic numeracy and literacy isn't enough. We see the expansion of normal schools, the push of education into post-secondary school environments, things like that. Pivotally, what we also see at this point in the 1900s is the one best system emerges from administrative progressives is a split, essentially, of the field of education. On one hand, you have teachers. And by and large, what teachers look like are young, unmarried women who are available in large numbers to fill the classrooms in this emerging system of mass schooling. And above them are administrators. The administrative progressives were strong believers in scientific management, which was all the rage in our rapidly industrializing economy at the turn of the century, mass industry. And so the administrative progressives were saying, hey, listen, we should be running these public institutions just like we would a factory. We need scientifically trained administrators who are there to make sure that teachers are operating as efficiently as possible. After all, we're using public funds. We need to maximize outputs. And so, of course, when they were framing this notion of who these scientific managers would be in the school system, it was not the young unmarried women who were providing the vast majority of educational labor. It was, well, people like me. White men who were adopting a more professionalized stance, who were there largely to manage the human resources of the system, namely the teachers. And so what we have here is a part of the field of education, an administration which is rapidly professionalizing. They are given credit for having specialized knowledge. They have substantial social value. They are respected within their field and the broader public as somebody who has to do a complex and difficult job, and they are rewarded commensurate with that. And that still continues today. The average principal salary in Montana is about $96,000. And that stands in stark contrast to how teaching develops over time. So remember, teachers, largely young, unmarried women, are lacking in systemic power, political power compared to administrators. So their way of trying to achieve better pay, better working conditions, better life, quality of life for themselves as laborers doesn't lie in professionalization as the administrators went, looking more like doctors and lawyers. It looks instead like labor power, the birth of large teacher unions like the UFT, AFT around the 1910s, 1920s, as teachers begin to collaboratively get together and push against the administrators that were kind of sitting on top of their profession and saying, hey, you can't pay us starvation wages. You have to provide us with better quality of life and working conditions. We demand more stability, an end to patronage systems in which our jobs hang in the balance of whether or not the principal that's above us likes us or not. And so what begins at that point is a several decade push in which teachers are doing things, stop me if this sounds familiar, like going on strike, whether the system allows them or not, forcing the system to recognize that what actually makes mass education happen are not scientific managers sitting at the top, but instead the teachers in every single classroom, every single day teaching students. And what we see, this is by the way, an AFT meeting in Chicago in the 1920s, and there again, you can kind of see this stark divide, a lot of female faces in that audience, all working together to press for better conditions for each other. And so what we see is over the 1930s and 40s, 50s and 60s, this sustained press of labor power by teachers against the framework of the system in which they operate over time, fighting hard for the right to collectively bargain with their employers to enshrine the parameters of their work in contracts that they could hold the district accountable for, the right to things like academic freedom and greater stability against the political upheaval surrounding the position. This was particularly important in the 1950s with the specter of McCarthyism and the Red Scare going on as teachers became particularly targeted by a number of folks who were looking to score political points. That's how we get the fight for tenure in the K-12 system and where that system has largely come from. The dismantling of patronage systems, again, making sure that we're making personnel decisions on the basis of fairness and objectivity rather than, again, politics, particularly gender politics. And so after these decades of pushing by labor unions and teachers against the system, we emerge in the 1970s with what I'll call kind of what we think the equilibrium of teaching looks like. And I want to introduce this to you as kind of what the prospect of teaching was for many people who came kind of before the generation of teachers that are sitting in classrooms now. And this was it. Listen, if you become a teacher, you can count on competitive wages, job security, generous retirement benefits, all of which have been fought by those for by those who came before you. Teaching was, particularly for women, a gateway from the working class to the middle class, a gateway to a good standard of living and a solid and respectable life, which was notable because in many cases women were shut out of that gateway and other professions that men had access to. So what happened? We have the prospect. Go into teaching, you can have a good life, because of what we fought for over the last several decades. What I tend to think of this as is an erosion of the foundations of that bridge to the middle class, the erosion of that prospect that we put forward to teachers if we go back 30 to 40 years. It begins, you can argue, in 1983 with the publication of A Nation at Risk. For those of you who are familiar, A Nation at Risk was a report commissioned by the Reagan administration. And it is, I don't think it's underselling it to say that A Nation at Risk is a masterclass in political rhetoric. At the time, it exploded onto the scene and fundamentally changed the story that we told about our American education system. If we go back to the 1950s, particularly in the post-war era, the public school system and its teachers were the pride of America. We said, after all, our young men that we sent across the Atlantic that fought back the Nazi menace and the Japanese were educated in America's public schools. They received this well-rounded education. It made them better than everybody else. And that's why we emerged from the war as the world's preeminent superpower. And then we go into the 60s, the 70s, the rising Soviet threat, Sputnik, the threat of nuclear destruction and mutually assured destruction, shakes the foundations of our social perspective on ourselves. And a nation at risk points the finger at one party in the erosion of the American promise, the American public school system. It says, we have accepted mediocrity in our American public schools. We have allowed students to fall behind in mathematics, science, and literacy. We're sending, this is actually in the report, we're sending seamen out to sea on nuclear subs who can barely operate the reactors or read the instructions to do so. It calls what we have done in the American education system a unilateral disarmament, that if it was inflicted upon us by a foreign power, we would declare an act of war. This was language that shocked the soul, and it initiated several decades in which we engaged in sustained reform of the system to target things like gaps in achievement, to hold the system to greater degrees of accountability by focusing on defining educational standards, making sure that we're measuring student outcomes, holding schools and teachers accountable for what their students are learning. This turns into No Child Left Behind in the 1990s, now the Every Student Succeeds Act. The job of teaching in this era of sustained accountability has become more complex than ever. The demands are higher. Scrutiny is higher. Accountability is higher. But at the same time that the ask has increased, the rewards have potentially gone in a different direction. So let's take a look at that now. Let's look at these pillars of the gateway to the middle class. For example, let's look at compensation. By the 1970s, ubiquitous across states and districts in the nation is the notion of the single salary schedule. Anybody that's been a teacher is pretty familiar with what this looks like. You start off over there at 0 years of experience with your bachelor's, and you start at, in this case, this is a couple of years ago, an SD2, $37,000. But the promise is this: if you stay in the seat, if you do things like go back to school in a measured way, your compensation increases, 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 increases over time, building up to that living wage. Well, we hope, anyway. And this has been the dominant form of teacher compensation for decades. Again, it principally rewards things like time and service. It principally rewards things like whether or not I go back to get a master's degree. And we'll talk a little bit later about questions that surround whether or not that's doing things like rewarding quality, rewarding effort, encouraging teachers to try their best and push their students as hard as they can. Those are open questions. But it does emphasize things that you might expect teachers, again, in the gendered political situation in which they emerge in the profession, lacking systemic power to prize. Fairness, objectivity. It's not so much that your principal is making subjective decisions about whether or not you're going to make money. There is a system. It goes step by step by step by step. And that makes it fair. That's why teacher unions pushed as hard as they did for a compensation system that works like that. What we've seen since the 1970s, after which we saw average salaries kind of rising, 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 teaching looks good, particularly if you've been in for a few years, is a steady retreat in the size of those average teaching salaries over time. Now, that's a complex story. We'll take a look at it in just a second. That's a story that's less about teachers getting pay cuts than it is about demographics in some ways. And in addition, we've seen that give way to a furious conversation about starting salaries. Let me demonstrate this for you. So this is a table that shows you where states are in terms of average teacher salaries since 2010 or so, between 2010 and 2016. The graph is showing you that average salaries in the vast majority of states for teachers are falling. Montana, by the way, is right about there. So we're middle of the pack in terms of average teacher salary. And the good news is our arrow is going in the right direction. It's a little arrow, but it's going in the right direction. Now, what this graph isn't necessarily saying is that legislatures are slashing teacher pay. They have limited ability to do that because of the nature of collective bargaining. What I would argue to you that the graph is showing is a mixture of both changes in compensation, but also a growing demographic issue with teaching. And that average salaries for a long time in teaching were inflated by the fact that our teaching population tended towards the older side. So people who had been in the seat for a long time had climbed that ladder and thus were earning larger paychecks. But as they retire, teaching starts to look younger and younger. And that means that the folks are lower and lower on that salary schedule. So that's what's promoting some of that shift in average teacher salaries over time here. Other things that have risen to kind of challenge teacher compensation are not just how much money you make, but also cost of living. This particularly came up in the case of Wyoming, where teachers were really struggling with the rising cost of things like healthcare. So what these graphs are showing you up on the top is that premiums that teachers are paying on average across states for their health plans have been rising over the last decade or so. Substantially so. And that's even compared to other state and local employees, so other governmental employees with similar health plans. And on top of that, the bottom graph is showing you that as premiums are rising, eating more of your total compensation package, the amount that your districts on average are paying for those premiums is also going down. So you are kind of on the hook for a greater share of the contribution for that premium than you were in the past. So the premium's going up and you have to pay more of it, eating into your compensation over time. This starts to put the squeeze on teachers across the salary distribution. One of the big things that teachers in West Virginia were coming for and saying, this is unsustainable. We can't even afford to live anymore, particularly with the cost of healthcare and healthcare access in our state. But the story about average teacher salaries often occupies a lot of our discussion. And people say, well, an average salary of, you know, $60,000, $70,000 is not so bad. So what's your problem? The issue is that this story is obfuscating a more important story, I would argue to you, for the health of the profession. It's this. The graph on the left is showing you the worth of a bachelor's degree candidate going into teaching. Their wages compared to other folks with similar credentials in other fields. See, I told you I was limited on sleep, so now it's starting to catch up on me. I'm stumbling over my words. Anyway, particularly for women, this is an interesting story. So women are the middle blue line on the top. And what this is showing, if we go back to the 1980s, if I wanted to be a teacher as a young woman and I went to college, I got my BA, I could expect to earn almost 5% more than other women with similar credentials and levels of educational experience and outcome. Over time, that has steadily decreased. And now if we look in 2016 or so, I'm actually paying a penalty of about 16% if I am a young woman who decides to go into teaching rather than another career with my bachelor's, similar level of experience. Now, in some ways, that's a good story, because what that likely means is that doors are opening for women to other career fields that are more valued by society in terms of compensation. But if we're thinking about the health of the teaching profession, now we potentially have a problem. It's not so much that it's a gateway to the middle class for you, particularly as a young woman. Now we're talking about you paying a penalty for the privilege of going in to teach. Over time, the similar story for men, although men have always kind of since the 1980s and all the way to now, paid a penalty for going into teaching. But again, this is down to the gendered nature of the profession and the politics surrounding how we value men's work versus women's work. But on average, even if we take gender out of the equation, the story is this. If I want to go into teaching after I've worked 4 years for my degree, I am going to pay a penalty. A penalty for going into teaching relative to other jobs I can go into. This holds across states. This is what the chart on the right is showing you. So this, on average across the United States, if I get my bachelor's and decide to go into teaching, I'm looking at about a 23.8 or so percent penalty in terms of my earnings relative to other folks with my same level of education and qualification. In Montana, we're actually not doing too bad. We are down here on the smaller end of the distribution, but that's still not great, because we're talking about a 13% penalty for entering into teaching relative to other choices that I might make here in Montana. So we're doing better than the rest of the nation, potentially, but it's still not great. And also, it's not necessarily great news in terms of absolute dollar value in Montana, too, because that's more of an indictment of the current state of wages across the state, across our economy, than it is necessarily just about teaching. Let me show you why. Let me show you the top 10 average starting salary states. So top 10 states for average starting salary for teachers are right up there. Let's see if we can find Montana. Nope, Montana's not up there. You get places like DC, California, and those look like decent starting salaries, but you also have to take into account things like standard of living. So $46,000 in California doesn't necessarily go too far, particularly depending on what part of the state you live in. Having lived in California, it doesn't go too far. And I lived in Lompoc, which has an Air Force base and a penitentiary, and that's about it. And it still would not have gone too far. These are the bottom 10 states in the nation for starting teacher salaries. And finally, we find Montana on the board. Unfortunately, it's number 50 with a bullet down there at the end, with an average starting salary of about $31,418. And you'll notice some other kind of notorious names up here if we were looking at the list of strikes earlier. For example, Oklahoma right above us, Colorado, West Virginia, all on this bottom 10 list for starting salaries. I thought, well, okay, it's one thing to think about Montana in the context of the rest of the nation, but labor markets tend to be regional. So let's take a look at a regional composite of where Montana's at. This is a list of our 10 closest neighbors. And again, we see that Montana is at the bottom of the list for starting teacher salaries. Here's the prospect for me, folks. If I am a young person in the state of Montana, and I love Montana, and I do, I spent 4 years of my life under Montana as a miscellaneer. You have to love it. The prospect for me, if I want to stay here and teach, is that I am foregoing the opportunity to drive across the border in any direction and make more money just by moving. Going to Wyoming, I could be making, on average, about $14,000 more a year than I'm making by staying in Montana. And that incentives matter. Economics teaches us nothing else. Incentives matter for how people make decisions. So, one foundation of the bridge to the middle class on shaky ground. Let's talk about funding for the system. So, what we've also seen, particularly over the course of the last decade, is that we have systemic challenges in funding the system across states. And this largely originates, if we go back to 2008, with the 2008 crash. The graph on the left is showing you recessionary cycles in the economy. And in particular, we're looking at how states end up running up against revenue shortfalls and slashing their budgets. The red line is kind of tracking shortfalls over time. And you can see the recessionary period. So back in the 90s, we hit a recession. And when the recession ends, of course, so budgets tend to lag actual economic indicators. So the economy gets worse, and legislators have to react by slashing budgets as revenue shortfalls increase. So we tend to see the worst budgets at the end of the recession as states have to make up those gaps by cutting. But what is supposed to happen, in theory, is that we hit the end of the recessionary cycle, we hit the recovery, revenues increase, and so budgets normalize. And that's what you see back here in the 90s, right? We hit the peak here at the end of the recession, and we see budgets normalize with relatively few states indicating that they're cutting because revenue gaps are closing. To some extent, we see that again in the early 2000s. We peak at the end of the recession, things normalize, and states return to normal. And then we hit 2008. And in 2008, we see the same pattern begin to emerge, and then we hit the recovery, which we've been talking a lot about over the last few years. We're recovering. We've got a bull market. Everything is firing on all cylinders. Growth, 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 growth. But when we look at what's going on with state budgets, we don't see the same kind of normalization that we do in standard recessionary cycles. Instead, what we see is that budgets or states are hitting revenue shortfalls, and they continue to cut public spending. Now, that's a mixture of a few things. That can be a result of prevailing economic conditions. So if, for example, I'm a state that's relying on resource extraction, energy markets, and there are dips in the energy market that accompany the recession, my revenues may not spike back up in the way that we would hope to. The recovery isn't a recovery for me. But it can also be the result, and this is the case in many states, of changes in policy. If we redirect revenues to things like tax cuts, then we essentially cut our ability to return to normal budgetary levels for public expenditure. And what we've seen is that regardless of whether it's natural economic condition or policy changes that we're making at the state level, these failures to return to normal budgetary conditions in the state have resulted in real shifts in how we fund the public education system. This graph on the chart on the right is showing you which states have failed so far as of 2015, which is the latest data that we can get at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, to return to 2008 spending levels. And that's the vast majority of states are still spending below 2008 levels. And that's a problem both because it would be good to return to those 2008 levels and also because over time the system doesn't get cheaper. Inflation, rising costs, changing student demographics make the system more expensive. So if we're already spending below what we were before, we're in real trouble. Montana here, again, it's not necessarily all bad. We are getting close to the better end of the chart here where states are actually spending above 2008 levels, but we're still about 2% rather, below where we were in 2008. What that looks like in terms of real numbers, this is per capita spending right now. In terms of the rest of the nation, we're about 34th in per capita spending. In the region, we're doing okay, we're near the top. We spend about $1,610 per person in Montana on education, but we're definitely not tops in the nation. But whenever we talk about spending on the system, we have an interesting policy conversation because the argument for a long time has been, listen, we've been having problems with student achievement, gaps, et cetera, since the 1980s. This is an ongoing conversation that we've been having for nearly 40 years at that point. And the answer is always, let's throw more money at the situation. Let's throw more money at the situation. Money will fix it. And so we've been wrestling with this issue, this question of whether or not money really matters for quite a long time now. And what I would put forward to you, and so I asked the question on the slide here, does money matter? Does this matter, the funding of the system? We've got some really good work that's coming out recently from folks like Carabo Jackson, who I cite here at Northwestern. Now that the good side of being on the other end of 30 years of accountability policy is we're starting to get some pretty robust longitudinal data on things like student achievement and better ability to do things like track students' later life outcomes to what they to their outcomes in schools. And what Carabo has found is on average, particularly for children from low-income backgrounds and distressed socioeconomic environments, is that spending does matter. What we see is that increased per pupil funding is systematically correlated with large improvements in educational attainment. So whether or not I go on to post-secondary, college, things like that, my wages later in life, my family income later in life, reductions in the annual incidence of adult poverty, whether I'm more likely to end up poor. And the conversation has always also included this question of, okay, well, if we give you more money, maybe that matters, but are you spending it in the right ways? The good news from Carabo's work, and they've done some qualitative work in a lot of schools to back up their statistical analyses, is that often we do see schools using this in the right way. Now, that's not to say that we always have, but the good news here is that we've gotten a lot better at figuring out what tends to matter for students in different groups and particularly for student achievement. So what they find is that school spending increases tend to be associated with sizable improvements in things like reduction in student-teacher ratios, smaller class sizes, improved teacher salaries. So when we do put more money into the system, and it does appear to matter, schools are getting better. Districts are getting better at using that money in smart ways. So that's good. So, spending matters. But over time, the teachers have a point. We've walked back a little bit on our public commitment to funding the system, particularly compared to our commitment just 10 years ago. What about that last leg? Let's talk a little bit about the profession in decline. So again, I have kind of introduced the idea that since 1983, we've seen a substantial increase in the degree to which the system itself and teachers within it are held to public scrutiny. So despite, you know, these walkbacks in investment in the system, despite the declining rewards for teaching, the conversation about how, about the nature of teaching itself has only gotten more rigorous and more complex. teachers are held to a higher standard to with regard to what they do in the classroom. We hold them to academic standards that are determined by states, things like the Common Core standards, state standards frameworks. Students are assessed more rigorously than they ever have been. Numerous states are stepping back and saying, well, you know, when we look at what's going on in the classroom or what's going on with student achievement, shouldn't we be looking at what teachers are doing? After all, we have research, and this goes back decades to the work of Eric Hanischek and others, that say, listen, when we look at what contributes to student achievement and student growth, the most important thing when it comes to school level inputs is teacher quality. We need to make sure that we have the best teachers in front of these kids. Shouldn't we be holding teachers to high accountability for making sure that their students learn, that they're doing their job? And so state after state, Florida, North Carolina, Louisiana, many other states, Colorado among them, have begun to enact policies that place a much tighter microscope on what's happening in the classroom. How can we do things like hold you as a teacher accountable individually for the outcomes of your students on things like standardized tests? How can we make sure that you are doing your job? And on top of that, teaching has always been a political profession. You are always held up to public scrutiny and the court of public opinion. My students are always astounded by this. When I show them the Montana Code, did you know that under state law, teachers are actually held accountable? They are required to teach their students things like morality, justice, patriotism, all of these concepts that are contested and left open to interpretation. And we don't define this in state law, what this means. We just say that we expect teachers to do it. And that opens them up to sustained inquiry from the public. What if my morality that I'm teaching your students isn't the right morality, or you don't agree with that morality? And then you can go before the board, and all of a sudden we have a very political problem. So greater scrutiny on the technical end from things like accountability policies, standardized testing, greater scrutiny from the public. As our own public consciousness and discourse becomes more divided, we place greater public scrutiny on what's going on in places like schools around our children, as you might imagine. So, limited investment in the system, decreasing compensation, the rewards are getting smaller, but the scrutiny is getting heavier. Teachers are increasingly the focus as policymakers run on trying to fix the problems of the school system and improve student achievement, close achievement gaps. And that has real and tangible outcomes for the profession. For example, this chart is showing you the number of teachers that are enrolled in teacher preparation programs across the nation compared to the number of students who are enrolled in K-12 public schools. As you'll notice, student enrollment is relatively flat in the K-12 system, a little uptick, but we're not seeing a dramatic expansion in the number of students. So if you're wondering why we have things like teacher shortages, the bottom line might be one of the factors that explains why. What we see is a sustained decrease in the number of folks who are signing up to become teachers and go through traditional prep programs. This is showing you, on average, close to a 40%, over 40% decline in the number of student enrollments. But what about Montana, you say? I'm glad you asked. Let's take a look. I pulled this. These are Title II data. Title II of the Every Student Succeeds Act requires us to report on things like the number of students we have in our prep program. If we look at the state of Montana since 2010, we had almost 4,000 students enrolled in the 2009-2010 academic year in teacher prep programs across the state. We have roughly 9 providers here in the state. And what we've seen is, over time, we spiked up a little bit in 2010, but since then, a sustained decrease in the number of students who are enrolled in teacher prep programs. Almost 39% decline in the number of folks who are lining up to become teachers in our state. If we look at individual providers, you can see this really play out. I'm very happy and proud to say that here at MSU Billings, we are a large part of that pipeline that you're seeing up at the state level. So back in 2013-14, we had almost 938 teacher candidates here in the School of Education who were raring to go to become teachers. What we've seen since then is, again, a sustained decline in the number of folks who were lining up to become down to 594, which still puts us as one of the largest producers in the state. So go Yellow Jackets. compared to Bozeman, this actually kind of surprised me because I've just gotten used to thinking about Bozeman as the flagship institution, but their enrollments are relatively stable, but they're also a relatively small part of the pipeline. Only about 300 or so students coming out of Bozeman in their teacher prep program licensed to be teachers. So we reduced the rewards, we increased the scrutiny, and what we've seen is declining enrollments, fewer people lining up to be teachers. And my question to you is, when we look at the proposition, if I go back to the 1970s, the proposition was this: gateway to the middle class, sign up to be a teacher, and you can have a better standard of living than your parents did before you, particularly if you were a woman. You have a fair and competitive wage. You have long-term security, particularly after we win things like tenure. So we shield you from things like patronage and those political excesses that the public holds the teaching profession up to. A relatively high degree of teacher autonomy. Folks trusted their local teachers. They believed that they had the best interest of their children at heart. That proposition has changed markedly. Now, we're talking about not necessarily a gate to the middle class and sustained economic reward. We're talking about the potential of incurring a penalty for choosing to be a teacher. 13% less than I might make if I just go and do another job with my bachelor's degree. Stability in the long term, because tenure is still a thing, although many states have begun to push on the notion of whether or not we should be offering continuing contracts, tenure to teachers. In my home state of Florida, where I grew up, teachers actually no longer have tenure. As of 2014, new entrants to the profession are on annual contracts only. So at the end of the year, I lose my job. It is up to the good graces of the district I work in to offer me another. Now we hope that districts are rational actors. So of course, if I'm a good teacher, why would my administration ever get rid of me? But at the end of the day, mechanically, I lose my job every single year. That stability has gone away. And for folks who are just getting into the profession, not only do I struggle with these low starting salaries, but I am in a precarious position. For their first 3 years here in Montana and most other states, you are on that annual contract system. You can be let go at the end of the year for any reason. There is high risk in this job. That risk is compounded by the nature of accountability that teachers find themselves faced with, limited support to meet the demands that we put in front of them, public scrutiny for the things that you say. And the question becomes, is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the reward worth the risk? So I guess my question would be not necessarily why folks are fleeing the profession, but why wouldn't they? So, do the teachers have a point? I would argue to you that they do. That the teachers that are marching on the line, that are using their labor power to push back against the system, have drawn our attention to a reality that in many ways we've known has existed for a while. There are if you talk to new students who are coming in about whether or not their parents, particularly if their parents were teachers, want them to go on to become a teacher, what do you think they say? No. Don't go on to become a teacher. Go be a doctor or a lawyer instead. We tell stories to ourselves as teachers now about how we don't do this for the money. Of course you don't do it for the money. You do it for the love of the kids and your love of the profession, but you don't do it for the money. I guess my question to you would be, why not? Why shouldn't you do it for them? We do every other job for the money. Can't you love it and also make money? So where do we go from here? Oh, and by the way, the public agrees with the teachers. To close the loop on the story of all those strikes that I threw up on the screen earlier, by and large, the public has supported those teachers as they've walked out in West Virginia, in LA Unified School District. The public has supported those teachers with overwhelming numbers. The teachers won in every single case that I put up there. They extracted significant concessions from the state and the district. The public has recognized that the teachers have a meritorious argument here. So where do we go from this point forward? Again, I come to this from a position of advocacy and love of this profession. And I'm not here to tell people what they have to do. I'm just going to make some suggestions, some food for thought as we move forward about where I would like to see the conversation go. First, we've talked a little bit about increased scrutiny and accountability for teachers. And sometimes I think that makes me sound like I don't think we should be held accountable. trembled. That is the furthest thing from the truth. And I would argue to you that any teacher worth their salt welcomes accountability in their work. We want to be held accountable because we recognize how important and vital our job is. But what I would say is that, particularly in our policy, we have gone too far in the direction of outside-in accountability rather than inside-out accountability. Strong professions are defined by inside-out accountability, where we as professionals hold each other to high standards, have high standards for what we recognize as professional practice. So as we think about modifying evaluation systems, which is a thing that we're doing in Montana now, having robust conversations about how we evaluate teachers in our districts, finding a balance between these two things is vital. We should have some inside-out accountability because, after all, you know, I tell the story about A Nation at Risk, and it sounds kind of like I'm lambasting the report, but they had a point. Because for decades, we were systematically ignoring many groups of students, students of color, students with exceptionalities, folks who didn't speak English as their home language in the home, and those kids were being systematically left behind. George W. Bush had a point. We were leaving those students behind. And it wasn't until somebody forced us to pay attention to how well those students are doing that we began to do better, that we began to close gaps, that average achievement started to rise. So outside-in accountability is important, but it should be balanced with robust systems by which teachers can evaluate each other as peers, contribute to building each other's practice, engaging in more formative evaluation rather than summative evaluation, having real and frank talk about practice as educators and holding ourselves to high standards. And what that means from a system level is we have to create space for teachers to do that in the context of the classroom, making sure that they have time to work together, to go see each other's classrooms, to have these conversations. Alongside accountability, we've talked a lot about compensation tonight. And we can and should improve compensation for teachers. But I would argue that our old conversations about just trying to get average salaries up is the wrong conversation to have, particularly in the moment we are in the profession. We can spend more money on teacher salaries in ways that have better connection to student outcomes and the challenges that we're facing with the profession and recruitment. It's not about average salaries. We should be taking a much harder look at starting salaries and pumping those up to be commensurate and competitive with other choices that I can make as a young person. We should really think very seriously about the single salary schedule. We often hold the single salary schedule up as a sacrosanct thing as teachers, because after all, it is that fair system that has protected us from patronage and subjectivity for so long. But the single salary schedule has a number of important weaknesses. It does not do things like encourage me as a teacher to work harder, to pay more attention to my students. If I'm the young teacher who comes in at 6 a.m. and I'm there before my kids every day, and I am the last one to leave the building, that salary schedule does nothing to say to me, you are doing it. You're killing it, kid. We want you to stay. We want to reward you. We want you to keep doing this great job for our kids. So we need to create avenues for meaningful advancement for teachers and tie rewards to those things. Now, I'm not necessarily arguing that we should do things like tie kids' test scores to your compensation, which is a conversation we're having in many states. Because more often than not, states lack the technical capacity to do that in a great way. But what we can do, and this probably comes as no surprise because I come from the military originally, is come up with authentic means for advancement within the profession of teaching. Because right now, if I want to make more money as a teacher, my best bet is to jump over to the dark side and become an administrator or officer if you're coming from the military background. Why do we not have NCOs as teachers, non-commissioned officers, meaningful ways for teachers to advance as teacher leaders, senior teachers that are tied to improvements in their compensation? Ways that we can tie how well you're doing as a teacher to the rewards that you attain. And finally, we need to think very carefully about how we leverage money to incentivize people to go to hard-to-staff districts, for example. Make the juice, work the squeeze for a 20-year-old who is now looking at the prospect of earning less money to teach in a rural district, which is perhaps not necessarily where they want to spend their early 20s. Let's give them a reason to go there. We can do that. And in addition, what about hard-to-staff shortage areas like science, math, or special education? You should earn more money if you're filling a role that we need you to in the district. Those are things that we can do, bonuses, et cetera. And we have evidence, by the way, that those incentives work. And finally, when it comes to the more normative context and political context surrounding the profession, we need to, as a community, as policymakers, as citizens, recognize that there is no silver bullet that is going to solve the challenges of our school system. And I say that, challenges of the school system, and it sounds dire. We have a lot of room to improve in how we do schools. We have a lot of room to grow in how we serve students of differing needs, and we can do better. We can always do better. But I think we often don't step back enough to remember that we are engaged. We talk about the American experiment all the time. People say that all the time in the news media, and I don't think they really know what it means. But what it means is that we are engaged in a thing that has never been done before, self-governance of a diverse people. And in the same way, our public school system here is without many peers in human history. It is operating mass education on a scale that beggars the imagination. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars that are flowing through, serving hundreds of millions of students every single day, in a complex web of institutions and organizational units. They get kids from all walks of life, from 5 years old to college. It's extraordinary. And so it's not like there's a blueprint for how we do that. We are muddling through every single day, doing our best, and we are not where we need to be. But it's important to recognize that we're also doing something that hasn't been done before, and it's pretty tough. So there's no silver bullet for solving these challenges, and we should look to teachers to lead the way, to be strong professionals, to be part of those solutions, but we should also think more holistically about how we tackle these problems. I mentioned that we have research that looks at things like, tells us that teacher quality is one of the most important contributors to student achievement and student growth within the school. I left out another part of the story, and that story begins all the way back in the 1960s. Jim Coleman, a sociologist doing one of the most impressive sociological studies of education, particularly at the time because we didn't have the fancy computers we have now. One of my professors actually worked on Jim Coleman's team, and she would tell me stories about how they would transport punch cards carrying all the student data in the back of a truck. And she told the story once about how the box fell out and they had to collect all the punch cards. It was crazy. Anyway, what Jim Coleman found was that, there is some variability in student achievement that's explained by what's going on in the school, but the vast majority of difference in student attainment when we look across different schools is not explained by what's going on in the schools, but rather what's going on outside of it. So when we think about how we change policies, about how we tackle the problems of the system, we should perhaps be more willing to engage in a holistic discussion about what we change both inside the system as well as outside and around it. So, that's my spiel about what's going on with teaching right now, why teachers are out there in the news, demonstrating, striking, leveraging their labor power to raise these issues to our attention, to say that we're at an inflection point, that enough is enough, we need to have a different conversation about the profession and about the school system that we all care about. I'm tired, so I'm going to stop talking and ask if you guys have any questions about this stuff. Shoot.
Any advice for people coming into the field?
My advice for people coming into the field is that part of being a strong professional is being clear-eyed about the challenges of the profession and being willing to be an advocate. Just like all the teachers that we started tonight talking about are doing. To be willing to take a stand, to say, hey, our work matters. We do a highly specialized, complex job every day. You should value us as professionals. You should listen to our input about how we do this. And that often involves, as these teachers did, being willing to take a stand, engage in advocacy, stuff like that. We don't spend enough time talking with our teacher candidates about what it means to be part of that broader profession, to not just focus on what's going on inside of your classroom. And it's not that we shouldn't spend a lot of time doing that, because after all, your first 5 years are just going to be a hurly-burly of just trying to make it. We call it survival for a reason. But being part of that broader conversation, being part of that broader level of advocacy is so important for continuing to push for a better profession for all of us. But also, I would assert to you, is a part of the remedy for the attrition that we see in that first 5 years. Often, young teachers end up feeling isolated and alone and not part of this bigger framework of teaching. And so what we see is teachers leaving the profession because of a lot of the things that we've talked about tonight. But if you connect to that broader profession, if you get to know yourself as a teacher of English and what that means, or a teacher of young children or early childhood and what that means, those ties can help sustain you. So, get involved. Be part of the larger conversation. That's my advice. Yes?
So, you talked about how the
So, that's a good question, and it's not one that we necessarily have a great answer to. So the vast majority of teacher evaluation is done through observational systems. But what that tends to look like is that I, as your principal or assistant principal, go into your room. I have a rubric, and that rubric is determined through collective bargaining. Depends on the state and the district what that's going to look like. Here in Montana, we use the Charlotte Danielson Framework for Effective Teaching. Kind of. We call it EPAS now, but it's the Danielson Framework. And that gives me some things that I'm going to look at. And in theory, it is a robust framework for understanding effective practice. The challenge in educational leadership, teacher evaluation, stuff like that, is that our dreams for what we can do and what we should do always run up against the reality of what we can do and the resources we have available. So even though we may adopt a really robust observational framework for understanding practice, the extent to which we are able to adequately train administrators in understanding what they're supposed to be looking for in that framework, to be reliable so that one principal walks in your room and sees one thing, the next principal sees the same thing, they agree on what effective practice looks like, is limited. In terms, and that's not to say that administrators are bad, they're doing the best with what they have, but when you have two principals in a building and a whole lot of teachers, what those observations look like, I was actually just in Baltimore last week, and I went on learning walks with principals. And what a learning walk looks like is I'm going to go into your room. We'll be there for about 10 to 15 minutes. We'll do our best to observe your practice. And if we have a complex rubric, it's often impossible to do that. So in this case, these principals had shortened it down to GLOWS, so what I liked, GROWS, places that you have for improvement, and supports, the things that I need to do to get you there. Now, that's a fairly broad and not necessarily robust way of recognizing teaching, but it is them trying to do the best with what they have. And couple that with the fact that not every principal or assistant principal comes from a long teaching background or any teaching background at all, and you start to see the problems with the nature of observational systems and how subjective they can be. But that's not to say that standardized testing is necessarily the panacea either. So we've gotten a lot better with statistics, and I'm not here to demonize standardized testing to you. I actually hold that things like Smarter Balance are very well-designed tests that we have subjected to significant scrutiny. And so they can do pretty well at getting what your kids actually know on the standards. But the question is what we do with those things. If I am a particularly well-developed OPI or State Department of Education, we might do things like value-added analyses with those data. What a VAM is, for those who aren't familiar, I don't just look at whether or not your kids were proficient when you got done with them. What we can do is use statistics to say, well, okay, so your kid came to you here from wherever they came from before. We have years of testing data. So we can then look and say, well, based on how they came to you, we would expect them to grow this way. And when we look at what actually happened, if we see they grew more, well, then you have added some significant value to their growth. And we should reward you for that or rate you highly. And if the curve goes in the other way, then maybe we should be having a different discussion. The problem is, and teachers in general agree that things like growth scores and value-added analyses, in theory, are better ways to try to get at this that we're more comfortable with. But the problem is that doing those kinds of things requires two things. One is lots and lots of technical capacity. I have to have substantial amounts of test data longitudinally for kids in order to do robust estimates of where they're supposed to go in order to compare your performance to where we predicted. So I need a lot of data. I need a robust data system at the state level. I need statisticians working at OPI who are capable of doing these highly technical analyses. And all of that costs lots of money. So even though we have a lot of big states that are holding out bands and saying, this is the way of the future, for the vast majority of states, doing those kinds of complex analyses isn't really in the cards, because we just don't have the technical capacity without sustained investment. So we are in caught between a rock and a hard place, where we can do subjective observational analyses, but those require a lot of time, money, and effort. Or we could try to go after what we see as more objective measures of teacher quality, like student growth, value added, stuff like that, but that requires a lot of time and effort. So as you can imagine, in the political process and policy process, where we end up is somewhere in the middle, where we're not necessarily doing what we know we should be doing or what works best, but we're doing the best with what we got. And that often leaves teachers somewhat in the lurch, as well as students and others. I don't know if that answered your question. I'm practicing my wait time. Wait time. Wait time. Somebody gonna start the clap? I don't know. Yeah. The slow clap that signals the, there it is. If anybody has any questions, feel free to come up and talk to me afterward. Otherwise, I'm sure Darlene will give you my email address. You can shoot me an email. You guys pay my salary, so feel free to ask me questions.